Welcome, Capital Raisers. On today's show, the conversation was fire with Rob Anderson, who joined me, and we had a blast talking shop on RIAs, broker-dealers, managing funds, developing multifamily, and transitioning from single-check writers to working much more with limited partners. Are you guys ready to raise? If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop on capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show, episode 257. And it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Rob Anderson on the Capital Raiser Show, season 3, now brought to you by Pitch Decks, our friends at Richard Wilson's Family Office Club and his affiliated companies. I got Rob Anderson on here. We're going to be chatting it up about broker-dealers and RIAs and raising capital. This is going to be a lot of fun. Welcome to the show, brother. How you doing?
I'm good, Ruben. How are you?
Sweet. Yeah, I'm doing fantastic, man. Just got off another show with Keeley Hubbard. That was amazing. Capital raising coach. For the audience that has not heard of Rob Anderson, tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into this syndication business or commercial real estate and raising capital and stuff.
Yeah, a little different. I came from the securities world. I've been securities licensed since the 90s, selling products to Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, working for mutual fund companies, insurance companies, et cetera. So read Robert Kiyosaki's book 20-something years ago, bought a bunch of rental houses while I had the day job. And the problem is it created another job, and I didn't need another job. I already had a job. My now partner and longtime friend started my current firm, and he started doing commercial deals, and I got so fascinated with that that I started investing with him. I'm actually one of my firm's first investors all the way back to 08-09. Started seeing these returns, and I sold all my rentals. It's like, I'm out. Why am I doing this? And then I went passive on a full scale with him and then basically retired from my Wall Street job 4 years ago. And this is what I do now. So okay, that was a very condensed version. There's more to the story.
Yeah. All right. So what is it that you do?
I fund deals.
You fund deal as a broker dealer, correct?
I do. Yes. As an in-house broker dealer. So we bought a dormant clean broker dealer about 4 years ago.
Okay.
Changed the name, went through the whole thing. So we were funding deals the way a lot of people do, through private equity, through insurance companies, through family offices, et cetera. And there's nothing wrong with that. Those are great people. We still work with some of them, but they're really proud of their money. So we wanted to control the capital stack a little more, bring it in-house, cast a wider net. And that's what we've done.
So what does the capital stack typically look like in the deals that you're involved with?
They're normal. So I've got about 800 investors ballpark right now and growing that invest in our deals, as opposed to a single check writer. So there's syndications, probably not different than what you guys are doing and other people are doing, but it takes a while to build that. And so we had to transition from the single check writer, who would put up 90% of the deal. You'd bring 10% on a friends and family basis. And a lot of that 10%, as you know, is not just your own money. It's your buddy's money, yeah, your family money, et cetera. And so we grew that 10%, if you will, to be the full equity stack outside of what we contribute.
Okay. So a lot of people do the reverse. They have huge databases of LPs and they're tired of raising $50,000 checks from 40 people or 400 people. And they go after the single check writers. Now you did the reverse. Can you tell me about the philosophy? That's really cool that you started there. I've had a couple of people come on and say, hey, I'm doing the same thing that you're doing, Rob. I'm going from big institutional funding to raising from limited partners. What's the philosophy with the change? Tell me about that.
But a lot of it was, so I was in the financial services business. I had a very successful career. And the only reason I knew about private deals was because I had a friend. How many people make good money, have successful careers? And so this is what's funny, Ruben. So I can tell you, I've got hundreds of buddies in the mutual fund industry, the financial services industry. They're huge advisors. They actually never see this stuff. I talk to them all the time. I'm like, you work for, pick your shop, Fidelity, Vanguard, whoever. And you're like, you have never done this before? You're kidding me. And this is what blows my mind. So, you know, if you just stay to the Reg D space, there's ballpark 15 to 20 million accredited investors in the United States. Less than 5% have invested in a private real estate deal. The blue ocean just blew me away about what the opportunity was. And so part of it was, it always bothered me that people didn't have access, and the Jobs Act opened that up. But the bigger thing from a business control standpoint is, if you have a single check writer, they own you.
Yes.
And we don't like that. And a lot of times what our experience was, and I'm not saying not to do this to anybody listening, but this is just personal experience. Our experience was that single check writer had a 20 something year old fresh out of some fancy MBA school in the Ivy League area. And they're now trying to tell you how to do your deal. And they've never been a principal. They've never had their name on a loan. True. Hell, they don't even own a house. Yet they're trying to tell you how to run your deal. And it was wrong. And they cost us money. I have a specific deal where they cost us money. So being able to talk to somebody who's a doctor, who's an attorney, who's a business owner, or maybe they sold their business already and they got eight digits and God bless them for that. And now they just want to like find cool deals. Or maybe they're just a very good salesperson who makes several hundred grand a year and they don't want all their money in the stock market. So by buying software and creating a system, I like bringing a deal out. Plus, I never want more than 50% of my deal owned by one person. I don't want anybody to have control or voting rights because that's not fair to everybody else. It's not fair to us, et cetera. And here's the crazy thing. People go, you're nuts. You got to deal with 100 people in it. I've got a fund that has 441 people in it. That would make most people stress out. To me, I'm blessing 441 lives because I'm going to give them a return that the S&P 500 cannot give them. And I love that. And I know it's kind of insane and probably different than a lot of your conversations, but that drives us. Plus, we're probably across 1,000 investors this year, and it will grow because we get our investors mainly through referrals now from existing people that are like, hey, I want you to talk to my friend, my aunt, my uncle, whoever. And just the ability to have that net and you send it out and people want to do it. So as long as you have the software and the technology to handle it, the way I look at it is who cares how many people are in the deal?
That's a very powerful way to capital raise. I'm addressing the audience here. If you can create such a good investor experience where your investors are telling people about your deals, that's one of the greatest keys of success that you can possibly measure is how many referrals you get. And it can get to the point where you don't have to do any marketing anymore because you have so many people coming in from referrals. And of course, you have to give them a great investor experience and communicate with them and give them technology like you were mentioning so that they have a good enough experience where they brag about it to their friends.
And a lot of it is communication. I've had so many people that said, because of how you communicated with me during COVID is why I'm going to give you more business. So a lot of developers will say, or people in the business, I don't have any good news. So there's nothing to tell you. The thing that's, there's nothing worse than no news. No news is worse than bad news. Like you got to talk to people and be like, I have no update, but I wanted to let you hear my voice. That's value.
Okay. So tell me about the kind of deals that you do. Are they multifamily value add syndications or something else?
Well, we did a lot of that. Now we're in Texas and Texas got a little frothy, a little expensive. So we've shifted from value add to ground up construction. We have our own construction.
Okay.
Company. And because in a value add, you can make high teens, low 20s for a decade, but those days are gone. And underwriting a deal that gives you a 12 or 13 is not that exciting anymore. You can still get a 20 or plus in the ground up construction phase. Now, your investors get nothing along the way. So the risk return demographic's a little different. And so I have to have this conversation, or my team rather has to have this conversation with people. Hey, I got a great return for you, but you're not going to get anything for 3 to 4 years. You got to be comfortable with that, right?
Yes.
So in Texas, what we have in other parts of the country too, you have this massive supply and demand imbalance with people moving here versus supply, because we had 2 years of underbuilding, which is very different than 08-09. I always want to point that out. People look at real estate. So we've done a lot of multifamily just because of that. But we like medical, we like office in a certain market, we like land, we like mixed use, we love industrial. I got an industrial partner we do some stuff with on the triple net side. But I'd say the golden goose is still ground up multifamily. You can make people considerable returns.
Yes.
In not a long time. And you can flip some of the stuff in 3 years, depending on the market. And the exits are solid. Plus the other thing is, and catch this too, Ruben, the debt side. Everyone wants to talk about debt and interest rates and all this stuff. When you're doing a construction loan, you don't take all the money day one. They're in draws.
Yeah.
So you don't have that full interest expense until you're done. Well, when you're done, you're fully leased and you're about to sell the property. So what's happening right now, it does hit the margin a little bit, but nothing like, they still pencil incredibly well.
So on our build to rent projects, we typically go and acquire the land. We get engineering done. We put in infrastructure and then we syndicate. Is it very similar with the construction that you're doing where you don't take money until it's shovel ready?
Well, we've got a little bit of a more unique structure. We've syndicated land in a phase one part of the deal, and we actually pay people a rather high pref to borrow their money. And the only reason we do this is it allows us scale. So this way our capital isn't tied up in a single project or two projects or et cetera. This way we can do 5 or 6 or 7 projects. And so we've syndicated land acquisition in a phase one structure, and then we give them a pref. So they don't get paid till they get out. And so this allows us to take down the land and do all the pre-development work. And once all the pre-development work is basically your shovel ready, then we do a second raise to do the development side. And the development raise buys out the land investors, or the land investors can then stay in for the long haul if they want to. So we've got a phase one, phase two approach.
If they do that, if they come in with you from the beginning, is it a separate entity, a separate syndication that they roll their money into, or is it one syndication from day one?
It's a separate syndication, but you reassign the ownership, so it's not taxable.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so talk to us a little bit about why development makes a lot of sense right now in comparison to, because I'm very interested in sharing this particular topic with my audience as well, because we're in development in the built-to-rent space. Why are people moving away? I know it's a different risk profile. You're not going to get money or cash flow on a piece of dirt, but there's very lucrative returns. So tell me, what are some of the things that you really love? And what are some of the things that you say to your investors when you're telling them about development and why it's sexy?
So we're a Texas shop. And so people that invest with us are giving us their money because they want to invest in Texas. I mean, that's part of it. And cap rates have compressed so much here that you would buy something for a certain price in a value add deal, renovate it, raise the NOI, and sell it for a massive gain. Well, you're buying so high that there's only so much growth you can get to your NOI because of your acquisition price. And so what happened is the value add play got really skinny from a return metric. We were seeing people buying stuff knowing they're only going to get a high single digit return. It was insane what was happening as little as 6 months ago. We grew our construction company because you can still give an investor a easy, obviously there's no guarantee on anything, but it underwrites at a 2 to 2.5x in a 3 to 4 year period. Who doesn't want that type of return? And so a lot of it is based on, is the juice worth the squeeze? I hate that analogy, but people use it all the time, but is the effort worth the return? Is the return worth the effort is a better way to say it, because we're going to put ourselves at risk from pursuit costs, from the loan, from whatever it is that we're doing to go do the deal, to buy the land. And we need the return to be worth that risk. And so the value add play, at least locally in Dallas area, Houston area, Austin area, was not worth it. So we shifted to ground up. Plus there's this massive need for homes, like I was telling you. And so, you know, there's a massive supply need and rents have gone up considerably in the markets that we play in, to where the exit valuations went up exponentially higher than the cost of construction went up. So construction did get more expensive, as you know, from what you do, but nothing near as high as we can exit these properties.
Did I hear correctly that when people are coming into the land portion, are they in a fund that goes and gets diversified amongst multiple pieces of land, or is it just one-off syndications?
We do have some funds, but we haven't done it on the land side. On the land side, we've done it on a deal-by-deal basis.
Okay, cool. So tell me more about, what's your process? So it's two deals. You go through engineering, you get the infrastructure done, and then you have a second entity that purchases the syndication. What are the differences between the returns on each of those? And here's a very cool part too. For the people that stay in, are they really multiplying their ability to participate on both parts of the returns?
Yeah, so it's like a compounding effect.
Which yes, is, that's what I was looking for. Off.
Yeah, no, that's exactly why we do it. So we get to have less debt outstanding with banks because, as you know, banks are only going to lend so much based on your balance sheet. So this allows us to grow a little further is why we do it. Frankly, our investors love it because the land deals are only 12 to 15 months. And so some people just have a risk appetite where they like short deals and there's not a lot of short deals. So this gives them a short deal. So we may offer them a 15 or 20 pref to borrow their money to do what we need to do in that time frame. And then if they love the deal, they convert in. And so there is a compounding effect. They convert some or all of their equity or their gain, if you will, into the new deal. And that new deal, if it's ground up construction, could be anywhere from 2.5 to 4 years, ballpark 3-ish years, to build something from the ground up, fully lease it, stabilize it, put it on the market, sell it. and we sell into the DST space, which is the 1031 fund space through broker dealers. So we kind of got a unique kind of business model, if you will. We work with individuals up front, and then we sell through the broker dealer channel for 1031 purposes when we exit a property. So it's a kind of a full life cycle there.
I did want to mention this particular concept. It's not a question, but if you take a $30 million value add deal, you might have to raise $9 million for just to acquire the loan, and then another $3 to $4 million for renovations. So you might be looking at a $12 or $13 million capital raise on a $30 million loan. In development, you might raise $2 million to put in infrastructure, and then that's going to increase and force the appreciation of that property. And it might be worth $6 or $7 million. At which point, if you have $6 or $7 million in equity, you might only need like another $2 million to complete the raise. So instead of raising $12 or $13 million for a capital raise on a $30 million deal, on a $30 million construction project, you might only have to raise $4 or $5 million. Is this correct from your perspective?
Absolutely, it is. And we're doing a little bit bigger of a deal, but absolutely, because you're going to contribute your land as part of your equity when you get your construction loan.
All right. So just think about that, guys, when you're comparing apples and oranges with multifamily sub niche deals versus construction deals. So that's something that I wanted to point out. Now, I'm curious about this. You are a broker dealer. How is it set up? Does your broker dealer invest into your own syndications, which you own? How does that work?
Well, we have the broker dealer. So because technically, if you raise money as an issuer, there's this weird rule that can't be your sole job. Not that anybody follows a lot of this stuff, but the rule is your sole job cannot be money raising. You got to be part of the sponsorship group, and you're allowed to raise money on the side is technically the way it works. Or you have to be securities licensed.
Right.
Enforce this? Not a whole lot, but we wanted to hold ourselves out to a little high. I can always say I got a fiduciary obligation because I do, because I'm audited by FINRA. So it's a little bit more, it's a bigger headache, but it's a lot more value add to the investor. The main reason we have it is because of how we exit properties. So my sales team, as well as myself, we're all securities licensed. So this way, when my investors are dealing with somebody, they're always dealing with somebody who's Series 7 securities licensed and is part of the issuer. So that's just one of our value adds that we do for our investors. You obviously don't need to do that, but we've chosen to do that. And that's one reason we do it. It also helps us when we sell into the RIA or the broker dealer space to have a broker dealer, because that's how that transaction happens.
All right, let's talk about that. RIAs is a topic that we've kind of been starting to explore a little bit. How does it work? What is an RIA, a registered investment advisor? How do they raise capital? How do they get paid? Let's kind of explore some of these topics.
Well, you got to understand where it came from. And so in the old days, they call them wirehouses, but your typical stockbroker, which is now a financial advisor, call it Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Wells Fargo, wherever they're at, pick your firm. They used to be very transactional in how they would help their clients. They've shifted to more of a fee-based revenue model versus a transactional revenue model, meaning they used to get paid by putting you in an investment. And so then the argument was, well, did you put me in that investment because it made you more money than the next investment, even though the next investment might've been better for me? That was kind of the argument and the back and forth that clients, financial wealth clients would have with their wealth advisor. And then the RIA came out and said, okay, I'm going to leave the big firm. I'm going to set up my own firm or join with somebody else, drop my securities licenses and no longer get paid commissions. I'm just going to purely charge a fee to manage somebody's wealth. In other words, if I'm that RIA, I'm going to get my fee irregardless of what investments I put my client into. So I now am no longer have that potential conflict of, did you only put that me in that because you made more money? Question. And so that's the beauty of the RIA model, is they're going to get paid the exact same fee irregardless of how they invest your money. What that also does is that allows them the opportunity to not be handcuffed into purely the investments their firm offers. Mm-hmm. Now they can go find all kinds of stuff, even venture into the private markets and help their clients diversify through, I don't know, private real estate, maybe pick what you want to do. And so the RIA is really kind of, their handcuffs are off. They're free from an investment perspective. They're also, according to the law, they're actually a fiduciary, and that's another difference. And so not to get in the minutia on you here, Ruben, but
I like the minutia.
The advisor world and broker dealers, they are held to the standard of, is the investment suitable for my client? Now, this is changing. There's something called Reg BI out there, which is trying to make the advisor broker dealer world more like the RIA world. But for years, they only had to say, was this investment suitable for you? in the fiduciary world, they're legally responsible to say, is this in their best interest? It's a big difference. Why? If you sued the broker dealer, they would settle with you purely over whether it was suitable. If you sue the RIA, they're personally liable. You can go after them civilly. So it's a big, big difference. They're held to a higher standard. That's just an interesting kind of tidbit about it. But a lot of folks, like if you have a large team at Merrill Lynch or wherever, a lot of those folks will leave, set up an RIA, and they can become, what they, in their opinion, a better advisor to their client, but they also right. take away that conflict. And so that's why that shift has been going on for about the last 10 years, and it's been growing. What the neat thing about us is, so I can't pay an advisor a fee. I'm picking on my friends at Merrill. I got a lot of friends at Merrill. It's a great firm. Don't get me wrong. But in fact, a lot of them invest with us. I can't pay them a fee. They can't send me a client. That's called selling away. The RIA doesn't need a fee. They don't take fee. They don't take commissions. Sorry, I said fee. I meant commission. Like the RIA can't receive compensation because that's not how they run their model. They fee their client based on finding what is in their best interest of a great investment. So if that investor says to their RIA, hey, I'd really like to get into real estate. I don't want to REIT. I want to actually see a personal deal I can be a limited partner in. Can you find me something, et cetera? That RIA can literally bring them your deal, my deal, somebody else's deal. And that RIA, if they get comfortable on a due diligence standpoint, can turn their client over to us and invest. And then that RIA just simply continues to charge their client a fee on their overall wealth that they see.
All right. So I want to drive that home a little bit more for my capital raisers out there that are out networking and meeting people. If you come across an RIA and they have access to capital partners and clients that could potentially invest into your deals, they're not going to come into your deal as a co-GP because they have a fiduciary duty to their clients that pay them to manage their money. So you don't have to be responsible to invite them to participate as a co-GP for bringing capital into your deals. Rather, their clients are the ones that pay them. So make sure to understand that as you run across these RIAs. Anything to add on that?
Every RIA has a form. I don't want to bore the audience with the form, but basically it says how they're going to get paid. And it's at the bottom of their website. You can click on it and look at it. Every RIA files with the SEC how they're going to charge their client or how they're going to get paid. Some of those RIAs may actually come to you with their hand out and say, well, I want to be part of your deal. Most of them won't. Okay. So it's not a hard and fast rule. Most of them won't. Most of them don't want to muddy the waters. I only bring that up, Ruben, because you guys may run into that. But a lot of them won't. The bigger ones don't. They don't want to touch that. They don't want to be part of it because that's an outside business activity for the advisor. And you got a bunch of issues with that. So it never hurts if you go to the advisor's website, scroll down to the very bottom, you'll see some small print. It's their disclosures. There'll be a form there you can click on, and that'll tell you how that advisor gets paid. And that's a really quick way to understand, is this a good fit for me? Is it not? One other thing that we've had to do. So we have a fund, a triple net fund, and some, the bigger advisors will want your product on a custodian. That's the one hiccup that we've run into. I've had to get one of our funds both on Fidelity and on Schwab so these advisors could actually pull in their client's investment and look at it holistically. That is a whole different ballgame. That requires an independent audit. That's a whole lot of cost and expense. So you don't really do that unless you have something like a fund that you can scale up. If it's an individual project, you just got to tell them right off the bat, this is an individual project. It's not going to happen. But here's what I want to point out. I tell people all this time, hey, if you put your money with me, if you put your client with me, I don't do what you do. I'm not a wealth advisor. I'm never going to compete with you because there are other shops out there that sell real estate investment, private placements that are also running wealth management. And so you got to make sure you make that distinction. I'm never going to compete with your business. I'm just a good real estate shop for you to work with.
Very interesting. So you're a broker dealer. You can raise money as a broker dealer. But you also have funds where people put money, I believe, so that they can diversify into multiple deals. Is that why you do it?
Yeah, we have a multifamily fund. We have a triple net industrial fund. The funds are a lot of work, I'll tell you that right now. And they're a lot of expense. So we've actually shifted away from it, as funny as it is for somebody who's actually gone there and gotten a fund on Fidelity or Schwab. We've done it. It works. I can do it again if I have to. The individual deals people like. Now, the reason you go into a fund is diversification. The reason you sponsor a fund is you can charge management fees, you know, ongoing in a longer deal and a bigger deal. They're harder to manage, especially from an accounting standpoint. the individual deals, it's like a rinse and repeat. It's easier. A lot of folks like them. A lot of our investors are entrepreneurs and they want to see the deal. They want to see the underwriting. They want to see all the accounting and your pro forma and all that other fun stuff, right? As probably many of your investors are. So we found it. We actually gravitated back. We went full cycle. We gravitated back to the individual deal.
Cool. I'm just curious because I think a lot of people in the audience are very interested in funds and how to make them happen, what it costs and how do they structure them.
Okay.
You mentioned something that's really a big kind of part of it, which is they're hard to manage. They cost a lot of money to get all the individual K-1s and manage from a technological perspective, all of the investors. Yeah, that's a lot of times a separate service that you have to pay for.
It is. And there's a whole industry out there of administrators that you have to hire to kind of do that for you. Now, if you build that into your deal and the numbers still work, hey, go for it. Because if you got multiple assets in a fund, you got to do the accounting at the asset level, but then you also have fund accounting you got to do and you got to bring it all up. And then you got to figure out, and here's the other problem. As soon as you start auditing that, now you got to do annual valuations and that's a pain and nobody wants to do that in the real estate world. That's what you see in the large non-traded REITs. And so it's a whole different game. And you really, in order to justify that, you got to have scale. You got to have a $50 million fund to justify that, in my opinion, frankly. It's a lift.
Good stuff. Because a lot of people are touting, hey, just go start a fund of funds. You can do a fund on your first capital raise. And while there's definitely places where that works, just be aware that it's not always going to work depending on what it is that you're trying to accomplish.
And just for reference sake, our multifamily fund is $28 million. My industrial triple net fund is $26 million. So they weren't small, but they're not massive. In a perfect world, I would want them twice as big to justify the cost.
Okay, cool. So growing your database, let's kind of go into that. You moved away from institutional capital and single check writers, and now you're talking to more individual retail investors. How are you growing that database? What are you doing for your marketing?
Yeah, a lot of it is the same thing. Network, SEO is huge. You got to get your SEO figured out on your website. So many people are looking for this stuff now. People sponsor ads and stuff, but that's kind of transactional. I can't stress enough taking care of your people. The best advocate you'll have is somebody who's given you money. Right. If somebody is introduced to you, that's great. If they just find you on the web, they don't know you from Adam. But if their buddy says, hey, I put money here, you should too, you're about 80% there. And so what I think the industry does not communicate enough. Most people do quarterly updates. We do interquarter email updates as opposed to the full write-up. So I'm touching people 8 times a year. I have a team of people that make proactive calls and physically ask for, hey, is there anybody else we should be talking to? We do in-person meetings. In our top markets, we did 3 last year. Every time I travel, I go to my database and say, who's in this town I'm going to? I get meetings set up so I can go visit with them face-to-face. The problem with technology is it's taken this face-to-face. I love Zoom, what we're doing right now, but it takes the face-to-face away from people. It takes the relationship. If we were talking about people's hard-earned money here.
Yes.
You got to get belly-to-belly with them. I'm convinced of that. You got to get on the phone with them. That takes effort. That takes money. That takes people. But that's a lot of what we're doing to answer your question.
That's good stuff. All right, cool, man. Let's jump into the lightning round. So let's start with this question. What's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Oh, Australia, by far. My in-laws were expats in Australia, and so I had a place to stay. That is one of the coolest places. I live in Texas, so it took 24 hours door to door. So that was brutal. So you don't make that a quick trip. But Sydney is one of the most beautiful cities on the planet. I would go back in a heartbeat.
Favorite book of any kind?
Think and Grow Rich. Staple.
I just ordered like 20 Napoleon Hill books, all individual titles. So I've been really wanting to dive in much further with him. So that's going to be
fun. I read it in college
mm-hmm.
and I found it on my own. Isn't that weird? I'm kind of dorky, right? But it changed my mindset. I'm so glad I did.
What percentage of your success revolves around mindset?
90 plus. I'd say it's 90% mindset and 10% activity. I mean, if your mind's wrong, you're wrong.
How long do you want to live?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Long enough to see my grandkids get married. How about that? I have no idea.
That's cool. What do you do to elevate yourself in terms of creating greater success?
Self-awareness is huge. Your thought process is huge. You know, having kids has helped a lot because I talk to them about how you think and it reminds me, well, what am I doing, right? Too many people are too busy. Successful people study other successful people. I love mm-hmm. doing that. What makes them tick and why am I not doing that? How do I do more of that? Man, just stop and let your mind find the answer for you. So work on yourself.
Beautiful. All right, short answer on this. Best way to raise capital from your perspective?
On the phone.
Talk to people. Yeah, pick up the phone. That's good stuff. What do you love best about multifamily development?
Probably the returns. That's why we do it. I think it's got some of the best risk return. Best return for the risk you're taking.
Favorite childhood memory?
First home run, playing baseball. How about
awesome.
That?
That's I love feeling. Baseball memories. Yeah.
It's one of the best feelings. You finally get one and it's gone. You know what I mean? I have dreams about that. Like, I want to relive it.
That's so cool. All right. What do you love best about being a dad and taking your kids on adventures?
Read a book by Bob Goff. That's actually another book I would recommend. And met him in person, and he does this thing that I love that I've copied. It says, have an adventure with your kids, spend some money. And people are like, you're just spending money on your kids. No, you're not. You're spending, making memories. So when my kids turn a certain age, I did 10, you can do 12, you can do whatever. I have three daughters. I give them an adventure with dad. I said, what, not a trip. What is something you've always wanted to do that you never thought you could do? And you and I are going to go do it together. And we're going to make memories. And I'm going to speak into your life. Because the best way to get a hold of your kids is to put them on a plane and they're a captive audience. You take them out of town. Nah, don't bring mom. Just you and them, one-on-one. Oh. This is a one-on-one. They need to know their dad. Dads do not do as intentional or as good of a job as letting their kids know who they are. Be vulnerable. So when I take them on a trip, I let them know, like, my heart is, I lost my dad when I was in high school. It was such a tough experience. I let them know that. I let them see me get emotional because I want them to know that they can do it with me. And I'm very intentional about that. And I say, what's an adventure? And I'll just share it with you. My oldest wanted to see where The Sound of Music was filmed. And I'm like, holy cow, that's not cheap. But I did it. I took my daughter to Austria. It was one of the best moments of my life. That almost rivals Australia, to your question. My middle wanted to climb a mountain. Took her to Colorado. My youngest wanted to surf. I took her to California. Is it cheap? No. But these are memories I'll have with my kids forever. And they're not long, they're 3-4 days. And we have inside jokes that we still do that mom doesn't know about. And it's awesome.
I love it. So. Okay, three more questions. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Oh, I believe so. I'm a Christian. I have no shine about that. Doesn't matter what you are, but I think you got to have faith in a higher power. You can disagree with me if you want, but that's where I am. And if you don't have a moral compass, then I don't want to do business with you.
Here's my trademark question. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Yes, both.
Enlighten us.
My oldest, her name is Grace. She's my miracle baby, man. She spent 39 days in the NICU. She was not supposed to make it. To the point to where the doctor said when my wife was pregnant, we should look at options, if you know what I mean. And that really rocked my world.
Ooh.
And that little girl is my pride and joy, as my other kids are too. She's in college now and she's awesome. And it just goes to tell you, I love my doctor friends, but they're just practicing medicine. They don't always know. That's my miracle baby.
That's amazing. I love that. Okay, last question brought to you by Shanna Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
Man, I think we're here to make it a better place than where we found. If it's all about you, then I don't want to know you, frankly. Granted, we're trying to take care of our families, but if we're not making the world around us better, then what are we really doing? We're in America, we're blessed. We live so much better, we're so spoiled. There's a lot of things you can get involved with. I'm involved with human trafficking, homeless, all kinds of stuff, as anybody, and that's not about me, everybody has their thing. If you're not making the people around you better, rethink what you're doing.
I love that. Great answers on the lightning round. Thanks for entertaining us on that. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation, to my company, Legacy Acquisitions, and to our sponsors, Syndication Pro, the Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. Go check them out at CapitalRaiserShow.com. Rob, how does the audience get a hold of you?
Hit me on LinkedIn. Link in with me. I would love doing that. My website's BVCapitalTX.com. If you kind of send me a note through the website and say, hey, I heard you on Ruben's podcast, I'll call you myself. I'd love to talk to you. You never know if we can do business, if we can invest with each other, whatever the story is. But BVCapitalTX.com is the website. It's usually the best way to find people or find me.
Good stuff. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser, developer, or syndicator as they scale in their business?
If it's tough, it's supposed to be tough. If it was easy, everybody would do it. This sounds really like elementary, but so many people give up. Mm-hmm. Expect tough and be tougher. Get through it. There's always the other side.
Don't run away from it, guys. That's fantastic. That actually applies to me in a lot of ways. I love it. Well, this has been a hell of a lot of fun, Rob, man. Thanks for coming on the show. It's been fun exploring RIAs and broker dealers and development. So I really appreciate you coming on, man. And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
I loved it. Thank you.
The Capital Raiser Show.